Hello, everyone. It is a great pleasure for me to introduce to you Dr. Tariq Qadir, who is joining us from the Rumi Research Center of Mevlana University in Konya, Turkey. Dr. Qadir is an actual graduate of Swarthmore College, class of 1987, where he was a math major before turning his interest towards religion. Some of you would be similarly situated. But I'd like to say a little bit about his research interests. His interests lie in Sufism, Islamic philosophy, perennial philosophy, and Islamic environmentalism. Dr. Qadir received his master's degree from George Washington University, where he studied with the perhaps preeminent perennial philosopher, Sayyid Hussein Nasr, and then followed by an MA in Indo-Muslim culture from Harvard University before receiving his PhD in the UK at the University of Birmingham. There he wrote his dissertation on the Islamic response to our current environmental crisis. And today, he will be talking to us about Rumi, the Quran, religious diversity, and describing to us how these things can combine to frame interfaith dialogue. So it's a great pleasure and an honor that we welcome our returning alum, Dr. Tariq Qadir. Thank you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, most gracious and most merciful. Well, it's interesting to be back at Swarthmore, though a lot of things have changed. Not the people, really, but the buildings. Because I was telling Ellen Ross that I remember going to Sharples, making a shortcut here across the field, where Kohlberg wasn't at that time. We had this parish extension, and German, French, and Spanish was taught here. So it's a good, interesting experience. It's also good to be speaking about a subject I like without feeling, you know, tension about exams tomorrow and so forth, which always made the experience of Swarthmore difficult. The beautiful campus I can enjoy for the first time, which we didn't have a time to do when I was here. And I was trying to do too many things, mathematics, philosophy, engineering, oh my God. Anyway, so, but the subject again is pluralism, and I think Swarthmore really is the place where I began to think about pluralism. And my own life has taken so many different paths over the years. I have a great deal of experience in actually experiencing different paths and even living in different cultures. For instance, I was born in Bangladesh. I came here as a freshman when I was 18, and then lived in America for next many, 27 years maybe. Then I went to Turkey, where I live now. This is my third life in terms of cultures that I've been exposed to. All right, so anyway, thank you very much for inviting me to Swarthmore College and the Religion Department, and thank you all for coming and sharing, spending your time here, because I know time is extremely precious, and nowadays probably nothing is as precious as time. And the fact that you're giving me this time away from your time to do homeworks and prepare for your exam is a precious gift, and I really thank you very much, because I know exactly where you are, because I've been in this position before. Anyway, so pluralism, where do I begin? On the train, I changed the approach to how I will present, and now I may completely mix up things, but I was assured by Professor Al-Jamil that you will not figure out, you will not know where I'm mixing up things. But I doubt. I know Swarthmore students are extremely sharp. Okay, religious pluralism. You know, we live in a world with many different religions. That's a given. It's not our position to deny or accept. It is already there. We have Hinduism, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, Buddhism, Zen, and so forth. So the question is, how do we live with the plurality, with this great diversity of religious traditions? And it's important because religion for, even now, after 200, 300 years of enlightenment and Renaissance and then scientific revolution and enlightenment, religion continues to be a central part of the identities of the majority of the human population still. And it until enlightenment or even 100 years ago, it was probably the central for almost everybody. I mean, the vast, vast majority. So it continues to be a central aspect of who human beings are, how they define themselves, etc. And in this modern age where we have to intermingle with other people, we have to work with people of other cultures, other people belonging to other religious traditions, so interfaith dialogue is increasingly more and more important. 100 years ago, 200 years ago, it was not really as important. We didn't have to. I mean, people from Bangladesh were not regularly coming to New York and working with Christians and Jews and Hindus. You know, I lived in New York for 13 years. So I know what plurality is, how it is to live with diverse groups of people from every country on earth. This was one great gift of America to me. But after I came to America, I met people from everywhere. First at Swarthmore and then in New York for 13 years. And I was also exposed and I studied the different religious traditions and different philosophies. Anyway, but interfaith dialogue, you know, I've thought about interfaith dialogue. What does make sense? What doesn't make sense? What's interesting is that the way interfaith dialogue is conducted today and the people who are interested themselves are often not very religious. Okay. So that makes interfaith dialogue a bit problematic. Because if it's to be a genuine interfaith dialogue, it must be among genuine representatives of each tradition. What was prevalent in pre-modern religious attitudes? I think these were the main attitudes, let's say before 18th century, until the Enlightenment, let's say. You could say, only my religion is true, all other religions are false. Or, my religion is true, no need to know about other religions beyond what my religion says about them. Maybe there are other variations of this, but these, I think, were prevalent positions in the pre-modern times. And this did not actually lend to interfaith dialogue that much, and it was probably not that important also. People didn't mingle as much. That's one reason. However, this is not to say that in many areas, let's say in India, in Egypt, at least in the Islamic world, because Sufi Islam, according to what we know about Islamic history, was like the predominant stream of Islam across the Muslim world until maybe about 100 years ago. And as I will show you briefly, that it has an opening to other religious traditions. But I'll not go into that right now. Anyway, so this is a prevalent pre-modern religious attitudes. After the Enlightenment, and in modern times, what we find, I think, are something like this. New attitudes after the Enlightenment. Different religions say different things, but if religions were from an objective truth, they would all be saying the same thing. This is an argument. So they must all be false. If religions came from one truth out there, why are religions so different? Actually, Karl Marx made this argument, and in claiming that religions are rubbish, false, all religions are false, because if they came from one truth, if there was one God, they couldn't be so different. Now, here's another possibility, number two. All religions are about the same values and same ultimate truth. It is the forms that separate them. Hence, if we can ignore or reduce formal aspects of religions, we may bring about greater harmony in the world. You see, the first attitude, I said scientistic attitude, because this kind of developed after the scientific revolution and after Enlightenment, which was which took Newtonian worldview as sort of the basis of what you can certainly grasp as truth. And these are my levelings, you know, I mean, you may dispute, there can be other levels. Third possibility nowadays, a postmodern attitude. There is no ultimate truth. Different religions are just different meta-narratives and perspectives on life and the universe. Now, what's interesting is that, okay, I mean, people can have their views, but this does not lend to genuine interfaith dialogue. So the first, you know, first definitely denies validity of any religion, because if they're different, they're all false, so why an interfaith dialogue between false things? And same with the third one, there is no ultimate truth. In postmodern attitude, that everything is just meta-narratives. So again, it undermines the very basis of religion, because every religion believes there is an objective truth out there or in here. You can say it in any way you want. So this postmodern attitude denies the very foundation of religion. And the New Age attitude, there is an ultimate truth and the values are all the same. This is cool, but they don't like the forms so much. They think forms create trouble. Forms are that which separates people. So if we can ignore or somehow reduce the formal aspects of religions, we can have more peace between people. But again, the second option undermines religion. And because the vast majority of people in the world do not buy into any of these three options, if not vast majority, at least the majority. So if we want to have genuine interfaith dialogue, which I think should be between genuine Christians, Christians who believe in Christianity, Jews who believe in Judaism and practices, Muslims who believe and practices, if there would be a dialogue between them, that I think would be a true interfaith dialogue. And in that dialogue, communities from different traditions would know about each other. Oh, you're a Jew, or you're a Christian, you're a Muslim. Well, how do you see this thing? Not just between academics also, because religion is not just concept, but it's also practice. And often in practice, we know the efficacy of a particular tradition. So for a genuine dialogue, there must be genuine representatives. Otherwise, even if we have a nice talk and we all agree with each other, the vast majority of people out there will not take us seriously. Okay? So the question is there another vision that allows for genuine interfaith dialogue? Is there a vision out there? And I believe that what the Quran, what the Rumi has, and I didn't want to mention Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, his own example, but these actually provide a model where you see that different traditions are being respected and accepted with all their forms intact, while accepting they're all from God, but at the same time recognizing that they're different. See, it kind of provides a model that allows people to come together without having to reduce the formal aspects, without having to ignore their formal aspects, and still believe that we can have a dialogue between us. Now, so first I will begin with Rumi, because people love Rumi more than, I mean, at least in the West, they love Rumi more than the Quran, so I want to go the easy way. All right, what did Rumi say about religious diversity? Before, this is the summary of Rumi's position on religious diversity, but before you read this, you can read it, but I have to tell you the story behind this one. This is from Masnavi, which is Rumi's most famous collection of verses. And in this story, Prophet Moses, peace be upon him, comes across, encounters an illiterate shepherd adoring God. And the prophet hears this illiterate shepherd say, "Oh God, I love you so much, I want to comb your hair, wash your feet, bring you milk, tie your shoelace, and so forth." And Prophet Moses heard this and said, "Oh my God, what are you doing? Do you think God is your uncle? God is not like a human being. He's this creator of this great infinite universe. How can you address him like that? He has no form," and so forth. You know the way Judaism is in I mean, the view of God is in Judaism. And this poor shepherd, he was shocked. He heard this guy is a great prophet. And he said, oh my God, I wasted time, maybe. And he stops his adoration. He gets confused. He gets up and he walks away. And at this time, at this point, God turns at him and said, you, what are you doing? So this is what Rumi said God told Moses. And in this, you also see Rumi's view of religious diversity, what Rumi's view of religious diversity is. So God told Moses, rebuked Moses, you have parted my servant from me. Did you come as a prophet to unite, or did you come to separate? I have bestowed on everyone a special way of acting, and to everyone a form of expression. What may be honey to one is poison for another. I am independent of all purity and impurity. I did not ordain divine worship that I might make any profit. No, but that I might do a kindness to my servants. In the Hindus, the idiom of Hind is praiseworthy. In the Sindhians, the idiom of Sindh. I look not at the tongue and the speech. I look at the state of the heart. Quote, I mean, you know, on and on. So this is it. What you get from here, first of all, God in the Quran is as-samad, self-sufficient. He doesn't have any need. He does not need our worship. If we worship, is for our way of accessing. And God has provided different religious traditions for different communities so they may try to approach God. That's one thing. And what is right for group A may not be right for group B. So the forms of the religions can be quite different. And what ultimately counts is the state of your heart. Do you love God? Are you kind to others? Are you loving? Are you generous? And so forth. Quality of your hearts. At the end, I look not at the tongue and the speech. I look at the state of the heart. Okay? You can be speaking whatever language, I mean verbally, but the state of your heart is what God is looking at. So this is the summary of how Rumi sees it. Now, like I said before, you say, oh, you know, Rumi was a Sufi, and he was a great Sufi, and the Sufis say wonderful things. But when it comes to real Islam, you know, it's a little different. But I want to tell you, and I think a lot of you know, because certain of my students have read everything, at least that's what I thought when I was here. Anywhere else, there would be straight A's, you know. We had this T-shirt, I don't know if it still exists. Do you still have that? See, it's a very popular T-shirt because it's a reality, okay? Inclusive Quranic verses. Not all the verses are inclusive, but these are. And I have not quoted every one of them, but trust me, there are many of this kind, but I've chosen some key ones to convince you. But even if you don't convince, if you are not convinced by what I said today, at least you should know that what we are discussing today is quite different from what the extremists on all sides are proposing about how, with all our differences between human communities, including with different biological communities, how we should live in this earth that we all share. For every community, there has been a messenger from God. Okay? This is a direct quotation from the Quran. This is not an interpretation of Sufi or any other kind. Truly, those who believe, and the Jews and the Christians and the Sabians and whoever believes in God and the last day and performs virtuous deeds, surely their reward is with their Lord, and no fear shall come upon them, neither shall they grieve. Okay? So every messenger is sent to every nation on earth, and then specifically Jews, Christians, Sabians, another group that existed in those days, not anymore. And if that doesn't make you happy enough, then whoever believes in God and the last day and performs virtuous deeds. Last day here can mean whoever believes that you have to account for your actions, accountability, the judgment, that if you do bad things, you'll pay for it. If you do good things, you'll be rewarded from it, or that it will be a credit to you, however you want to see it. So all these people, anybody who believes in God, believes in accountability of actions, and performs virtuous deeds, all saved. This is a Quranic position, and this verse has been repeated at least 2 times, and there are other verses that point at the same direction. Now, some historically, many commentators have said, oh no, but these verses are abrogated. But then there are other commentators who have said, no, abrogation applies to legal rulings, the Sharia, some details of Sharia, not to the promises that God makes. Otherwise, why is it in the Quran anyway? I mean, in my perspective is that if this it had no meaning, it would not be in the Quran. But there has been throughout Islamic history who believe that this is true, okay? That this is not has not been cancelled. And notice, one of the verses where this appears is 112th revelation. 112 means that's almost at the end of the Prophet's career. It did not change. There are 114 chapters in the Quran. 112 is just maybe 1 year before he passed away, and the revelations, of course, it stopped before he died. Now, this verse kind of summarizes the whole approach, and you will see how similar it is to what you saw in Rumi's verse. For each we have appointed a law and a path. And if God had wished, he would have made you one people, but he hath made you as you are, that he may put you to test in what he has given you. So vie with one another in good works, and to God you'll all be brought back, and he will then tell you about those things wherein you differed. Okay? So here again, you see, God is one, and he has sent different ways, different approaches. The forms are different. And it may not be clear to us, but if we do good works and we draw nearer and nearer to God, so let's say if we are God-realized or self-realized, right, then we may figure out what are the differences. The differences may not make sense to us. Why are this difference? But once we get to the top, once we have God-realized, self-realized, we may realize, or if we die, we have no option, things would be opened up. The Prophet, peace be upon him, said, human beings are asleep, when they die, they awake. So, as if some veils are opened and we see the reality as it really is. Okay, and these verses confirm the last point that Rumi made, only the heart counts, only he will be happy who comes before God with a heart free of evil. It's a paraphrase, I mean, basically the same thing that Prophet Muhammad said, God only looks upon the quality of your heart. Now, this does not mean that Rumi and the Quran do not criticize other religions. Of course, the Quran says that we have not mentioned the names of all the prophets, all the messengers. Some we have mentioned, others we haven't. So there is no mention of Buddha, for instance, or Krishna, or Rama, or any of from other traditions. But Abrahamic traditions, there are a lot of mention of Moses and Jesus and all the biblical prophets. In fact, in the Quran, in one instance, there is a criticism of Judaism, but it doesn't apply anymore. But otherwise, there is no criticism of Jewish theology. There is a lot of criticism of Christian theology. But on one aspect, really, any perceived deviation from viewing God as one ultimate reality, Quran and Rumi definitely reject the idea of Trinity as an ultimate reality, or if Trinity implies God is one of three. They categorically reject the idea of Jesus being Son of God, if that means a God begetting a person, like human beings have children. Otherwise, there is no criticism of Jewish and Christian customs, religious forms, rituals, so forth. Sometimes there might be, if again it's related to that perceived deviation from seeing the ultimate reality as more than one. Okay, so this is an important point. So yes, there are criticisms, but not about the forms of the religions. For Rumi and the Quran, all the essential message of all the religions are this. Ultimate reality in metaphysical terms is one, and in regular theological terms, God is one. the ultimate purpose, submission to God, or you might say purity of heart. Either way. But these, according to Rumi and Quran, all authentic religions would have these two things. And you see a Quranic verse confirming that exactly. We never sent any messenger without having revealed to him that there is no deity save me, therefore you shall worship me alone. Now, what is interesting is that in spite of the theological criticisms, in spite of the theological differences between Islam and Christianity, and mind you, I told you, there is really no criticism of Judaism. If there are any criticism of Jews, it's about political reasons, not theological criticism. Now, there is one aspect, but it's not relevant anymore, so I don't want to mention it. So in spite of theological criticisms, in spite of theological differences, you find in the Quran there is a recognition that the Jews and the Christians worship one God, same God as the Muslims do. So you see verses like this: every religious community faces a direction of its own, of which God is the focal point. I mean, the word is Allah in Arabic, but same idea. If God had not enabled people to defend themselves against one another, monasteries and churches and synagogues and mosques, in which God's name is abundantly extolled, would surely have been destroyed. So there is a recognition that in monasteries and churches and synagogues, just as in the mosques, it's God's name being, I mean, God being worshipped, God's name being celebrated. So this gives Muslims an opening. Now, those who you might call fundamentalists, they don't want to look at these verses and they want to interpret it some other ways, and they want to bring up some other verses and do not want to interpret them in light of these verses. What is really happening, I think, that people have their own ideas about what should be or should not, and they choose some verses from the Quran and say, oh, look, this is from the Quran and we must do this, but they ignore some of these verses and the interpretations. They may choose some interpreters and not other interpreters, so forth. And you see, Rumi also has the same idea. In every religion, the ritual prayer is different, but faith does not change in any of them. Its inward states, its orientation, and so forth are all the same. So there is the recognition that even though, and notice that this is not just about Judaism and Christianity. Remember, Rumi said in the first verse I quoted, the Hindus, the idiom of Hind is praiseworthy. So it's not just Judaism and Christianity, but all religions. There is a recognition that in spite of our disagreements with exactly how to view God or the ultimate reality, there is a recognition that these different people are seeking God, worshipping God. So that is the opening for Muslims. It is a totally valid opening that Muslims can make use of in any interfaith dialogue. So this approach, you know, allows for differences between religions and the point of agreement that they all came from the same God. And this is very important in any interfaith dialogue. It's important to emphasize what is common. And that is that everything, I mean, at least from an Islamic point of view, that all religions come from one truth. For instance, I and you are two different human beings. If you may look different, you may believe in different things, you may not have gone to Swarthmore College, but I can't deny your humanity. You know? So we cannot deny that essentially these are religions. We cannot deny, even if we disagree on some surface things, even if outwardly we are different, we can't deny that these are not, we can't say these are not religions, only my religion is religion from God. And I want to point out those who think that, you know, Sufis are wonderful, they have gone beyond forms. Rumi being one of the most important spokesperson for Sufism, to him forms are very important. And one of the things about Rumi is he always said, nothing is without a purpose. So if the exposition of meanings, I'm reading out his verse here, if the exposition of meanings were sufficient, the creation of the world would be vain and useless. If love for God were only thought and meaning, the form of fasting and prayer would not exist. This is a cute little argument. And he says, forms witness your love for each other. That's the way we give gift to each other. It's not those things, but those things are witness to our love for each other. So likewise, in a sense, God gives us a form of worship, and we return it by sort of adoring him through that form. It's like lovers giving gift to each other. That is Rumi's poetic way of explaining. But to him, forms are important. That's the key I want to point out. And forms are different. He recognizes that forms are different. For instance, wine is okay for Christians, not okay for Muslims. And in for Muslims, it may be dangerous. I mean, spiritually speaking, that wine may not be, it may kind of violate. I mean, it may kind of undermine the integrity of the path. And like that verse I quoted in the Quran, which said, you know, even if you don't understand the differences, when you come to God, God will explain to you. But just right now, just do good works. You will not understand until you come to the final point. So Rumi is basically saying the same thing. How are you going to unify religions? On the day of judgment, it will be unified. But here in this world, which means the world of multiplicity, world of forms, that is impossible because everybody has a different desire and want. In the world of multiplicity, everything is different. Every one of us here are different. Not only in appearance, in our ideas, there are lots of differences. What do we want to pursue and so forth? But we are all human beings. That's our common thing. If we didn't have much in common, I couldn't possibly communicate with you about anything. And like the fact that I can communicate almost with anybody from the street, that shows our common humanity. Something, even a person I've never met before, if I can relate, that means something in him is in common with something in me. And a great deal, in fact, almost all of me and the other person is saying. Okay. So finally, this great variety may be explained in this one verse. We sent no messengers, the Quran says, except with a message in his own people's language so that he might make the truth clear unto them. Now, one thing I didn't explain is in Islam there is also a belief that God has created the universe to reveal himself. And because he's the infinite one, an infinite one cannot reveal himself just by one creation. If God only created me, you would probably, if any of you believe in God, you would probably stop believing in God. But God being the infinite one, is infinitely creating at each moment more and more creations. And the Quran says it in poetic terms that if all the oceans and the seas were turned into ink and the trees turned into pens, it would still not be able to finish describing or glorifying God, speaking of God, and so forth. So, now, given that God is engaged in this infinitely different types of creation, we have different climates, different cultures, different human beings and communities with different inclinations. So if God wanted to be known as the One, how would he make himself known? By giving not the same revelation to everybody, but different one according to what fits in, how to catch this community, how to get this community turned towards me and know me from God's point of view. So that is an explanation. This is like the language. God sent in the language of the people. Language doesn't just mean this language you speak, but the means of communication. So the Quran is very clear about this. God sent messengers to the messengers in his own people's tongues, in the different tongues, not just in Arabic. It could be as many languages as there is, not just spoken, but as different human communities with different inclinations, they have been given messages accordingly. To make them realize the same deal, that truth is one, God is one. So, this is the end of my not the whole presentation, I'm sorry. The Quranic and Rumi's view of religious diversity. And I believe this model allows for dialogue without having to deny each other's form. And I think this would be more of a genuine dialogue than the one we have today often, where we think the forms are creating trouble. If we see forms coming from the divine, forms also have a kind of a relatively absolute value. If it is coming from the absolute, it has a relatively absolute value. Now, I want to turn next to perennial philosophy, because perennial philosophy is really a 20th century intellectual movement, mainly by Muslim intellectuals who are also Sufis generally, actually all of them. And it kind of follows the Quranic model, but it makes an attempt to see religions globally and see how we can appreciate each of the traditions with all its symbols and rituals and everything. And this is mainly their perspective. Why is there a diversity of religions? First, they believe there is an absolute truth. Second, they believe that there is an archetype for everything in that absolute truth. Sort of like Platonic ideas, if you heard of Platonic ideas. Probably most of you did. So every tree, human beings, they all have a kind of an idea. It's like I'm an architect and I have an idea of what kind of building I want to build. And then I manifest that in action. But this idea of the building, like Kohlberg, and I have a design in my mind. So in a sense, it's like God has a plan for everything, like a tree. Oh, this is the pattern. And God says, okay, let it now manifest. And it manifests in tree, in unfolds in time. So everything has an archetype in that sense. And religions, too, have an archetype. This is the perspective of perennial philosophy. They also often call themselves traditionalists. Why? Because they believe in practicing the whole of tradition while respecting other traditions. So according to them, there are two reasons why religions are different. First, here I think, differences among archetypes for religion. So God has one, like Islam has one archetype. It has certain potentials that maybe the Christianity doesn't. And Christianity has another archetype. It has certain potentials that others do not, and Buddhism, and so forth. And the second reason is the differences among human communities, which I mentioned earlier, because of God being of infinite nature and infinitely different creations, you have different cultures and so forth. So these two things, differences in archetypes and differences in human communities, kind of unfold in historical time what we experience as religions. And for these reasons, there are differences. So the differences are not only determined by the conditions on the earth, but they're also like a divine archetype for each religion which fits into these different conditions. So this is basically why they believe there are differences. And it's a little similar to the Quranic position. And what they say is that people often say, you know, they're so different, religions are so different. But they say, if you look at from an inner point of view, from a metaphysical angle, there are certain principles which are not exactly the same from one tradition to another, but there's sort of a correspondence. So religious differences are often exaggerated, unless you're only looking outwardly. Inwardly, if you look from the point of metaphysical principles, you see a pattern emerging. It is not exact, but they correspond to different traditions. So, you know, like beyond being, pure being, etc., etc. If somebody asks a question, we can go into that. Also, in the world among different religions, there are two types of founders. You have a prophetic model where God sends a revelation through the, you know, I said logos. Logos is the creative aspect of God. To human beings who is, let's say to Prophet Moses, God sends a revelation who is inwardly united with that creative aspect of God. Because the prophets, we believe, are in a way united with God inwardly. But outwardly, they are not conceived as God. They are united with that creative aspect, the creative intelligence of God. But outwardly, they are not conceived as God. And the other pattern is incarnation. So this creative aspect kind of descends as a human being. So in Hinduism, we have avatars. In Christianity, we have Jesus the Christ, God coming to the earth. So what perennial philosophy does, really, is to find a pattern and see how we may make sense, even though there are so many differences, how there are things in one tradition that is not exactly one-to-one with other, but how there is a correspondence. For example, in Christianity, you have Jesus as the Word of God. In the Quran, it's not Muhammad is not the Word of God, but it is the Quran. But in Christianity, it's Jesus. So there is the idea of Word of God, but it's manifesting in different ways. In Christianity, the Word of God is born of a virgin woman, Mary. In Islam, the Word of God, the Quran, is manifested from an illiterate prophet, a prophet who didn't know how to read or write or was not educated in a worldly sense. He's known as an illiterate prophet in that sense that he didn't go to schools of the world, but he learned, it's a virgin nature of him that gave conception or conceived or received that revelation. So there is that correspondence, and it may have meaning or similar meaning in different traditions. So this is, perennial philosophy provides a way of making sense of the differences. And it also speaks about different families of religions. So you have Abrahamic traditions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Indian religions, Buddhism, Hinduism, shamanic religions. You know, Abrahamic and Indian, you know, you have the prophetic model and avatar. Shamanic model and primal model are kind of similar. In shamanic model, what happens is the founders, I mean, there can be many founders, really, but they kind of go in and out of ultimate reality and come back, like if you have read Black Elk Speaks, go on a vision quest, goes in and out, receives messages. So it's sort of a prophetic model. Not exactly in the sense that prophetic is used in the Abrahamic tradition, but is in this worldview, of shamanic worldview, they're getting messages from the ultimate reality. Perennial perspective also speaks about relatively absolute, that the forms in each tradition have their absoluteness within the traditions. For instance, you know, there are a lot of universes in this world, I mean, in this universe. In the Milky Way, we have heard there are millions and millions of universes, or thousands and thousands. And each one of them has a sun. But if you ask me, where is the sun? I'll point to the sun that I know. So even when I know there are many, many suns, many, many universes, in my universe, this sun is the sun. So in the Christian worldview, and mind you, until modern times, people had only one worldview. That was the worldview of religion they were associated with, except maybe a few hundred people here and there. But the vast, vast majority of people in the Christian world believed in the Christian worldview, in the Islamic world, the Islamic worldview, and so forth. The religious worldview of Islam, Muhammad, Prophet Muhammad is the model. Within the religious worldview of Christianity, Jesus Christ is the model. Within the Buddhist worldview, Buddha is the model. But these are, from a perennial perspective, relatively absolute, not the absolute. However, from within the tradition, it is the absolute. It is the absolute way. No one goes to Father except through Jesus. Of course, we don't believe that in Islam. But we say that God says in the Quran, if you love God, follow me. I mean, say, O Prophet, if you love God, follow me and God will love you. So for us, Muhammad, the model of Muhammad is... But we don't deny any of the prophets. We don't deny the customs and outer practices of any of the religions. So this actually is kind of obvious, this and knowing who were the people who formulated this perennial perspective, they are almost without exception were informed by Islamic mysticism and the Quran, Islamic tradition, most of them are Muslims. And it is a kind of a borrowing to create a model that others can contemplate about how we may live with different faiths, with different traditions, and respect each of the traditions in their entirety, and have a dialogue a genuine dialogue. I think that is a good alternative to what we have, where we don't even accept the validity of the tradition very often. That's all I have to say. Thank you very much. So, if you have questions, yes. What is, mention one polytheistic religion. Tell me one that is left. Hinduism. Well, Zoroastrian ultimately is not. Ultimately, okay. Indian religions? Even Hinduism? Well, how you perceive, if you just perceive things in one way. In Hinduism, ultimately things begin with Nirguna Brahman. And Nirguna Brahman is one. Then you have Saguna Brahman. And all these different... Actually, I know about Hinduism as much as I know about Islam. So I have no problem with it for these reasons. In Hinduism, you have this Nirguna Brahman, which is one. You have non-duality, for instance, Shankaracharya's Advaita Vedanta. That's the ultimate which perennial philosophy requires. There is one ultimate reality. And when you talk about different gods in Islam, we say God is one, but we call God by at least 99 different names. These are different aspects of divinity. In fact, God is like, this light and the different colors in light. We don't see God directly. We see God's qualities being reflected in you, in the flowers, in the trees. So it's like the light, we don't see light as it is. We see through the reflecting glass, the seven colors coming out. I don't see, light is colorless, but we see everything in colors. What is beauty, beautiful things. So the difference is how you look at it. In Hinduism, these different aspects of the divine are represented by different forms almost. And in Islam, we don't present them in statues, in forms, but we still make distinctions. So Al-Wadud, the loving one, is not exactly the same as Al-Alim. There is some little distinction of quality, but it's still referring to the same God. So yes, but if you ask any Hindus, serious Hindus, let's say, do you believe in one God? They will say yes, there's only one God. Like in Bengali, my mother tongue, and also in Hindi, Bhagavan. Bhagavan is one. Okay, Bhagavan comes in different forms. Fine, but Bhagavan is one. Ganesha and everybody else. That's one answer I give. You had some other questions? Please. Yes. Let me speak about Buddhism, for instance, which is a major. It can be a major problem because they don't talk about God. They don't talk about revelation. Okay. Now, perennial philosophy sees revelation doesn't have to be just from Gabriel or from outside. It can be also from inside, illumination. If Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree didn't have a revelation, why he was like a changed man? What happened? Something from within illuminated him. That is, from a perennial's perspective, that is also a kind of revelation. You don't have to see it everything from a Judeo-Christian perspective. Do they call it God or not God? So perennial philosophy in a way helps you to see God in different lights. So in Buddhism, what is real? Nothing in the transient world is real. That is true. But there is something real, that is nirvana or sunyata. And if these were not real, if you say, they are not real, then why do we bother with Buddhism at all? Nirvana is real. Nirguna nirvana is real. If it wasn't real, we wouldn't bother with it. So, and God in every tradition is what is ultimately real. Okay? So from that perspective, yes, there is God and revelation. You just say it in different terms. Yes, right. Well, maybe you came late. What I meant was that you actually believe and practice the religion, so you can be a witness that your religion indeed transforms your heart. So then you can be taken seriously by vast majority of Hindu, Jewish, or Islamic, whatever community you belong to. So then the dialogue between representatives as such can be taken seriously by the vast majority of people who practice those religions. as a genuine interfaith dialogue where different representatives of other traditions are learning about my tradition because I'm a genuine representative. Yes. Yeah. I think you're right. There is a problem right now there, but we have to recognize that what binds us, I mean, within one tradition, of course, first of all, the perennial perspective is saying that all different traditions, Islam or Hinduism, which appears radically different on the surface, but inwardly are very similar, actually. But, and within Islamic tradition, we believe in the same Quran, we believe in the same Prophet, and so on and on. There's much more in common than between different traditions. So perennial philosophy is not into, you know, calling people non-Muslims. It may not exactly fit into this model, but it is, as far as I know, accepted as within the variation, within like human beings, within any one community, within any Islamic community, there can be people with different ideas, different understandings. Yes. How the archetype unfolds in historical time. It can unfold, you know. I mean, let's say you have a good idea. The good idea can, in time, in different cultures and different historical time, unfold in a particular way. But it doesn't have to be evolving. It is adapting to different traditions, different changes in history, to return at all times to recognize the one reality. But actually, that particular verse, that was like a year before the Prophet passed away.
But
no, not exactly, yeah. Because sometimes in the same chapter, you have some verses from one time, other verses from another time. But still, the order of revelation is more or less okay. This particular, you know, list that I chose.
But
not that. That's why, you know, that particular verse was Surah chapter number 5, but it was in chronological order, it was 112th revelation. But it's not that those numbers are not same. This can be confusing for those who may not know this aspect. And that's why I actually wrote it down, this 72nd revelation or whatever. It's a reminder from me, actually. I don't want to confuse you with so much data. Yes. I'm not sure if I understand your position exactly, but how do we apply it? First of all, I mean, conceptually, if we can accept such a model where the differences in forms are accepted as valid from different perspectives, as also descending from absolute truth. So let's say the cross, a symbol of Christianity, is Jesus Christ being sort of relatively absolute model, and the cross is related to Jesus Christ and the history of his life. So the cross also has a relatively absolute quality within Christianity. So if we can, these are like keys, intellectual keys, by which we may think of religion globally, think how we may accept, we may see different perspectives. It is a kind of intellectual venture, but these are like keys to different ways of seeing religions, and not just say, oh, this religion is so different from that religion, and so forget it. Just like I was talking to you about Hinduism and Buddhism and Islam, for instance. What is an authentic religion? Authentic religion is like there is an ultimate reality. You know, like I said here, there is an ultimate reality, and a revelation, in a sense, descends, whether it comes from inside, you know, a deep down, a reality beyond what you can sense with your ordinary senses or your ordinary rationality, that there is a belief and actually an awareness of this ultimate reality, because all the prophets and the saints spoke about it. Why do we believe that? Just like you believe in the scientists, you know? No, I wouldn't, but I'm not doing that. What I'm saying is, if people say, how do you know that there is an ultimate truth? How do you know? We know because the prophets and saints have said it, and they have shown us ways of experiencing that. Just like now, for instance, Do you believe that this Earth revolves around the sun, you know, or moves around the sun 18,000 miles per second, I think? Do you know that? Do you know that? I mean, 18,000 miles per second we move. Do you have any proof? You don't. Let's say E equals MC squared. You heard of this formula, right? Do you have any proof? No, but you believe in it because Einstein said it or some scientists said it. But most people have no clue about how to prove it. And too many things about science. Yes, I mean, if I drop something, it will fall. That is kind of obvious. But let's say how the computer works, you have no idea. The scientists come tell you, and you vaguely understand, oh, I don't care as long as it works. I believe in the scientists. No, I'm not. I'm saying both are actually same. We have beliefs in science, and we also have beliefs in religion. And both can be proven in their given ways. In science, you prove through things outside. You can repeat an experiment. Not in every case. For instance, in the case of evolution, you cannot repeat. But when it comes to religion, the proof cannot be demonstrated out there. You might get an inkling, but it can be realized in the heart. And this is what all the saints and prophets have said. And what they say is that if you can get rid of anger, hatred, envy, jealousy, greed, pride, then your heart becomes pure and the heart becomes, and this is the key to understanding the difference between science and religion, heart becomes an instrument of vision. In Islam, we say ayn al-qalb, the eye of the heart. It sees infinitely more. It is like God seeing things. In Hinduism, they call our third eye. And in different traditions, in Meister Eckhart, for instance, says that in the heart there is something that is uncreated and it perceives. Even Plato said it in Timaeus, I think, that the ratio, the ordinary rationality, is different from intellectus, which perceives. Thomas Aquinas and the scholastics also said this many times. So there is a proof. When you purify your heart, if you can get rid of anger, hatred, envy, jealousy, greed, pride, so forth, the heart becomes an instrument and a vision which gives you the proof of what the prophets and saints say. If you need the proof, if you walk the path, you can get the definition for authentic religion is some, if you believe that it has come, or if the religion claims that it has come from that ultimate truth. And if there has been people in the tradition that indeed confirming that yes, there is an ultimate truth, then it is an authentic religion. So Hinduism, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, Buddhism, these traditions at least we can say these are authentic religions because they believe in an absolute reality, okay, and then they believe that the ultimate goal is the purification of the heart or submitting to that reality. If reality is one, we have no other choice but to submit to it. What else are you going to do with this? If reality is one, we must conform to reality. Reality cannot be two. We cannot live in two orders of reality. I always love questions because when I'm asked a difficult question, it forces me to search for the answer.
Well, if they're authentic, let's just continue on.
Well, this is the criteria. Do they believe in an absolute truth? Do they believe that ultimately truth is one? That's the number one thing. If a particular tradition does not, then we have to think that maybe there is a problem there. If you can think of one, I'm not sure of an inauthentic one, but I cannot think of one. But if somebody, you know, every other day there can be a new teacher and say many things that, oh, you know, you will migrate to this planet called Chiron or something. Ultimately, Chiron is God, or, you know, there is Chiron, and then there is Moon, and these two kind of... I can sort of cook up some, you know, meta-narrative of how things came about, and I would say by this criteria, that would not be a true religion. For religion to be authentic, according to this model, there must be one ultimate truth, ultimate reality. I'm not sure what exactly Scientology says.
Well,
I know Tom Cruise is.
Yeah.
Because I don't know Scientology very well. I don't know. The other criteria for an authentic tradition would be if there is what we call in Islam a barakah, a blessing on the path. So if a tradition is real, then in time it produces saintly human beings. I don't know if there is any saintly Scientologists, except Tom Cruise. Yeah, I mean, we can't judge a religion too much, except some things that may really cross the line. In a Scientology is only like 40 years old, maybe. Well, we'll see. We'll see. I don't know about Scientology.
Well, thank you for coming, and thank you all for coming.
Thank you, really.